without hesitation, as she had done it without hesitation. Ianthe held your hand gently by the wrist, considered the angle, and thrust the blade home. Every fibre in your being bent toward not throwing up. The delicate tendons in your palms snapped under the razor-sharp blade. The steel juddered against a metacarpal. Chips went flying into the muscle bed. Your blood sprayed promiscuously against your face, a hot, salty thickness of it against your lips, your nose, your right cheek. Your eyes rolled back in your head in an ecstasy of suffering. The world rocked. You saw the body, pressed against the back wall, her hands clasped together as though in prayer. You looked at the blade sunk deep into your hand and looked at Ianthe and for a moment understood that she was about to press the mechanism and rend your hand utterly, leave your palm a smoking ruin of gore and muscle, of whiteness of bone, that you were being punished both, perhaps, for the kiss and for something you could not even recall doing. She pulled the blade clear. This was also agony. Now you understood the object lesson. There was no sewing up for you. Your meat was left ripped, bare and vulnerable, a gaping, heinous hole in your hand, your skin a pitiful red and pink mess of shredded dermis. You grasped the wrist she was also grasping with your free hand. You poured thalagy in with embarrassing torrents, a hot, shameless gush of it, flicking free chips of bone and wending muscle back into muscle. This took effort and thought. You refilled the blood, grew new shiny spans of skin, left your palm as whole as before, your nerves screaming, shaking with the memory of pain. "Harrow," said Ianthe gently, "don't fuck with me. I'm not here for your amusement either." She turned away from you and walked toward the door. Your mouth was dry. You kept trying to re-wet it, but you were afraid that it would come out as bile. Your head was swimming. You steadied yourself enough to say, "Is your cavalier a forbidden subject, then?" Her hand stilled at the pad of the auto door. Standing by the hanging that showed the first house picked out in white thread. "Babs," she said. "I don't care about Babs. Just don't suggest my sister is dead to me. Ever again." She touched the pad beside the door and crossed the opened threshold. The door closed behind her, leaving you alone. There was blood on your face and the knees of your robes. After a moment, you shook them clean as she had done, drying out the blood, rendering it powder. You were weak. You staggered over to the body, standing so quiet by the wall, and you buried your face in her thighs. The dead, cool nearness of her was so close to being real that it rendered itself genuine comfort. You were close enough to the crates, stacked up by the door now, to see that they had been placed against the wall hastily, and somewhat ajar. You wobbled to your feet, and pushed them down in a domino cascade of clanging plecs. Behind the boxes were hundreds of thick nail fragments, like the broken horns of some weird animal, scattered on the floor and embedded in the wall. Some of them were brown with dried blood. Long, ragged missiles of keratin were, at some points, finger-deep in the panelling. You crawled back to the cot where the body laid you down on the sheets, placed the heinous sword within your arms, added the letters to this pile, and gave you the go-ahead to fall unconscious. Chapter 5. She was first aware of light. It poured through the plex windows in lava-like radiance, white and steaming light, making her undershirt stick to her ribs with sweat. In the tiny black confines of the shuttle, the light took up all the space with its irradiating corneal presence, and Harrowhark cried out as though she were dying from it, and then was tremendously self-conscious and discombobulated.
"Please,"
a voice was saying.
Please, my Lady Harrowhark, be peaceful. What can I do for you? What must be done?
Ortus was almost bigger than the light, filling up the black and steel spaces of the passenger seats as much as the radiance did. Harrow realized, smarting, that his expression was that of a man who considered her a source of embarrassment. Somewhere down the years, she had come to understand that Ortus Nigenad, that perfect modern ninth cavalier, perfectly shaved head, perfectly appropriate paint, perfectly grim solemnity, perfect body of two cabinets nailed together, perfect ability to carry 6 kilos of bone, considered her a slightly sorry object. How sorry an actual object, he could not possibly conceive. "Am I making the sign?" she managed. "Am I giving you the signal?" "No? Then I will remind you that anything else is none of your business, and hope I do not have to remind you twice." He was not sweating as she was, but those lashes were damp from the light.
"As you see fit, my lady," he said.
His rapier was not belted at his hip. He carried it over his lap, as though it was someone else's baby. Harrow was pleased, dimly, to see that for his man gauche he carried his pannier, despite Iglamine cutting up so rough at the idea. That felt appropriate. She had always desired a helpmeet, not a circus performer. "Where are we?" Harrow added, in another sudden welter of nervousness. "I thought, perhaps..."
"We must be 400 kilometers above the surface now," he said, mistaking her question. "They are securing our clearance to land. We shall leave orbit soon, I trust."
Arrowhark rose from the placket of house dirt she had been sitting on, which held the merest suggestion of Thanagy at this point anyway, and she crossed to where the light was coming in. At the last moment, she remembered what she had brought with her and drew a piece of thick voile from within her sacramental vestments. She tied it around her head and pulled up her hood, which still smelled of the salts that Crux had so carefully packed it away with, that herbaceous, acrid, home-like smell, the one that made her eyes smart again with familiarity. Then she looked through the plexiform window. From space, the House of the First resembled a box of tumbled jewels. Haloed in white, its blues deep and brilliant and oxidized, a planet of water, close enough to the fiery gyre of Dominicus that the water was not allowed to freeze yet, nor so close that it burnt away. Insubstantial and ever-shifting ocean, as far as the reddened eye could see. Her smarting eyes fell upon a tiny jumble of squares, ringed around a central greyish smudge. She turned back to her seat and found herself saying restlessly, "At times now I forget. I thought I was dreaming, perhaps."
"I find it perfectly normal, my lady," he said. "Perhaps I am right in perceiving that you thought it might surprise me, your being with the infirmity of..."
When she looked at him, he immediately seemed to find the rattle and thump of the shuttle's mechanisms overpowering, and began a traditional Ortus shutdown.
"Your so-called... the frailty..."
"Nigenad, use your words."
"The insanity,"
said her companion. Her shoulders relaxed a fraction. He mistook her rising relief for an emotion he ought to have known she never felt. Ortus said, distracted,
"The only surprise really being in it expressing this way, rather than..." "No, I am not surprised, Lady Harrowhark. Perhaps you may yet have cause to find it useful."
"Useful?" Ortus cleared his throat. This engendered many emotions in her. Ortus Nigenad cleared his throat with the import of a sword being slid from a scabbard, or knuckle bones jostling in the pocket of a locked tomb necromancer, but it was too late, as he was already declaiming,
Then did the dire bone frenzy fall upon Nonius, the mightiest arm of the ninth and its bulwark. Spasmed his veins with the death lust, his great heart roared like a black iron furnace, hungry for corpses.
Ah, said Harrowhark. Yes, book 16. And, presently, I think bone frenzy might be a term open to coarse misinterpretation, personally. Better death by the drawn sword, and better the death of the knucklebone. There was only one trigger to drive Ortus Nigenad so comprehensively berserk, and she had forgotten that it was not a trigger to use lightly. Ortus primly said he thought that nobody who read the Noniad would be the sort of churl who misread a simple and evocative collocation like bone frenzy. He went on to suggest that such a person probably didn't even read in the first place, and would be more inclined to trifle with prurient magazines or pamphlets than to bother themselves with a complex epic such as the Noniad. He said that he wouldn't want such a person to read his poetry anyway.
At least now I possess the time to finish it, he added a little moodily, but apparently satisfied with that thought.
This surprised her only in that it was so obviously expressed. She did not voice what she thought, that even if he was right, even if the last thing Harrow wanted was for Ortis to get in the way as she studied the paths of lictorhood, to become a finger and a gesture, to take the only divine path that had ever opened for her in order to save her house from a destruction she herself had inflicted, it didn't behoove him to say as much. She hoped he never finished it. She hoped there was never world enough or time. Harrowhark had always thought Matthias Nonius, legendary cavalier of her house, sounded like an absolute horse's ass.
Harrowhark, said her cavalier, I wish to ask you a question.
He did not sound timid now. His mood had shifted to a more typical restrained sadness, though she thought perhaps there was something else within it. Harrow took a moment to study his face. Ortis would be a good rest cure, should the homesickness get too acute. He had classical ninth eyes, a tintless shade, very close to true black, sharply ringed around the iris, very like her own. Ortis said a little restlessly,
What do you think it is like to be a lictor? Do you think it is a central tragedy to them, their great age, their timelessness?
She was surprised again. Nigenad, what would be the tragedy in living for a myriad? 10,000 years to learn everything there is to know, to read everything that has ever been written, to study without fear of premature end or reckoning. What is the tragedy of time?
Time can render one impotent beyond meaning, said Ortis unexpectedly.
He made his eyes downcast again and said,
I would not expect you to be crushed by the weight of that particular comprehension, reverend daughter.
He might as well have said,
You are a baby of 17 and I am an adult of 35.
She regretted, not for the first time, not going for broke and taking Iglamine. Perhaps there would have been something in rocking up to the first house with an octogenarian in tow, a sort of wild and confident fuck you. Oh, your cavaliers are young, and they fight. How classic, so jejun. But that would not have been the wild and confident fuck you of the ninth house. The ninth house character, she was forced to admit, had always been low on wild and confident fucks. Nigenad, she said, I am what I am, and I am 17, yet I assure you that I contain multitudes.
I am fully aware of that, my lady, said Ortis.
Which was perfectly correct of him to say, but Harrow somehow did not like the way he said it. "They are taking too long to vet us," she said, and stood, and restlessly pulled down the plexiform barrier between them and the empty cockpit. She was about to press her fingers to the communication button to ask the pilot what the hold-up was and how he was to explain it, but she saw something she either had not seen before or that had suddenly appeared upon one of the padded seats. It was a piece of flimsy. She took it and withdrew into the bleeding light of the passenger hold. She could feel Ortiz's eyes upon her as she turned the piece of flimsy over. It was coloured all over with thin blue ink, scribbled so hard that the termination of each letter pushed holes into the surface, and it read, "The eggs you gave me all died, and you lied to me." She gave it to her cavalier. The shuttle seemed totally quiet now. No mechanism ground, no pipe gurgled. The light was very still and white, and she no longer felt it moving. He scanned over the piece of flimsy, frontward, then flipped it over to scan it backward. He cleared his throat. Harrowhark found herself flinching and nearly tore herself to pieces for it, and he said,
"It's blank, my lady."
"Fuck," said Harrow.
Chapter 6. When you woke, you were already sitting up. Your chin was bowed on your chest so that you had an exciting view of your lap. You were no longer in your bed, and the lower walls and floor were blurring past you in scuffed washes of black stone, bones and steel. Your vision swam. It became apparent immediately that you could not move. Your clinical brain rose to the fore as your meat brain shied and ran around and barked like the badly behaved animal it was. Your clinical brain took stock and realized that you were seated in some kind of chair being wheeled down an Erebos corridor, and that someone had pinched a high cervical nerve right into your spinal cord, not deforming the bone at all, but manipulating the flesh only, in such a way that you were locked out of your body from the neck down. You could not raise your head. You could blink and breathe sufficiently and swallow poorly. Otherwise you were as marble. It was an astonishing act of necromancy. You were righteously indignant, but amazed at the act. You were still in your beautiful mother-of-pearl robe, head deep in your hood, hearing the thick and papery rustle of 22 letters secreted within your clothes. The sword was laid across your lap. A thick, fatty webbing joined the hilt to your forearm, a webbing that you had no memory of creating, but was nonetheless your lacework. Perhaps you had woken up at an earlier point to stash the letters down your shift and fix the blade to your arm. You did not recall, but that was not unusual. Sometimes your conscious days were dreamlike ordinances of movement, functions, sounds. Rather than muscle mass within the web, there was a honeycomb of bone stretching out from your forearm through the webbing to the hilt. Nobody was going to get it away from you in a hurry. It was as though you had been picked up bodily, plopped in the chair, and disabled from the neck down. You hoped distantly that your bladder hadn't evacuated. The chair stopped. There were voices. You concentrated hard on whatever had been done to the back of your neck, visualized your known friend, the odontoid peg that protruded from your other known friend, the cervical vertebra, the bracelets that surrounded the vertebral arteries, the tangle of physial joints. If it had simply been bone work, you would have been able to identify the mischief immediately and unfuck accordingly. The voices coalesced. "Can clear this instantaneously, Saint of Saints, once the Holy Prince has finished giving audience to..." This came from in front of you.
"The meeting! The meeting!" It was difficult to articulate extra exclamation marks, yet the new voice did so. "Do you think I have time for... for the extra hour in which three generals and your resurrector, the god of dead kings, try to schedule another meeting after the first one has done? Do you think I came here to wait for three personal assistants, six calendars, and God himself changing his mind 19 times?
This came from behind you and above. This voice, in all probability, belonged to the person who was pushing your chair.
Sacred Hand, said another voice, forgive me. It was his order that she was not to be touched. There were no allowances. There were no riders.
The first voice said,
there was no opposition when I ordered the shuttle, nor to my preparations. The order regarding Hierarch Nonagesimus was specifically stated by him, Holy Finger, Holy Thumb.
The voice above Harrow said, and is my order suddenly not God's order? Am I no longer lictor of the great resurrection, the second saint to serve the king undying? Have I lost my rank among the four, or now, as I so horribly find, the three? Am I not the last sister serving in a charnel house of dead sisters, all of whom gave their long and dutiful lives so that your squalling children and their germ-ridden children's children's children could bask in the light of Dominicus?
The other voice paused. No, it said. But then it added, and there was a hint of stoic wretchedness.
Most holy saint of joy, forgive me. I still ask you to please wait until the meeting is done.
There was an explosive sigh.
It's all right, the voice said, quite normally. It's all right, Lieutenant. I understand. You've only met this baby and the other baby. You've never met a lictor. You're not to know, even if you're in his presence. It's another thing altogether to understand.
The voice trailed off, and the person standing behind your chair crossed over to the person in front of it.
You were distantly interested in what happened next,
if only because you were not used to being granted a front-row seat. You beheld one normal person before you. The other was a black hole. And now you knew why. And that person had two kidneys. A sudden 1-2 punch of thallergy emerged from nowhere, as far as your senses were concerned. No, not punches. A stiletto. An unutterably focused dart. A syringe. And each kidney was hosed with angiotensins. A perfect spike. Blood pressure plunged. A body joined the shoes and trouser bottoms in front of you as the officer fainted, and the chair was wheeled around the neat human pile. The voice behind the chair was muttering,
horrid, just vile. Erebor's placements never do have any horse sense. Told him time and time again to rotate them each decade. Just a nightmare. My presence ought to have the same effect as a fire alarm. I do not want to wait. I do not want a cup of tea. I am not asking for a feudal submission. I am asking for understanding.
This blast of volume might have made you jump, had your spine been connected. The chair paused in front of one of the elevator shafts. The dark doors whispered open to the rainbow inlay and the hangings of the lift chamber, and the chair was rolled inside. You were busy flexing the ragged end of your dorsal root. You had assumed it must have been severed, which would have been the simplest thing to do. But you realized all at once that it had been tied into a knot. It had been bowed out, twisted and looped. The keypad made low electronic chirrups as somebody pressed down upon it. A mass of fabric whispered past you. You could not feel it on your body, but you felt the air upon your cheek, and then a person knelt in front of your chair. A shining, shimmering billow of pale fabric came into your field of vision, a rainbow-hued whiteness that ran through shades beneath the hot tungsten light, like the reflection of coloured glass on ice, the same stuff that now was draped around you. Then, awfully, your vision was lifted. Someone had pressed a finger lightly beneath your chin, and they were tilting it up, so that you could see their face. You looked at the lictor. The lictor looked at you. The face beneath the icy, party-coloured hood was a prim, virginal oval, much in shape and feature, like the shape of a saint's face in a portrait, or a death mask. The nose and jaw and forehead were all carven and serene, and therefore had the same indifferent dullness of a well-formed statue. You noticed the colours first, beneath that harsh and unlovely light, that the hair was a dead flower or apricot colour, and that the skin and lips and brows were of a similar hue, so that beneath the nacreous cowl, the saint looked like a painting with a very limited palette. And the eyes? You had seen a lictor's eyes only once before. Lictors kept their own faces, but the eyes they stole from someone else. You had been lucky that your own transition was not as startling. This pair of eyes were a slumbrous, sand-tinted hazel with grey madder clouds within them, like a red hurricane moving over a gaseous mantle, like a storm-ridden planet of red dust. The expression did not match these dreamy and quite beautiful eyes. The expression was paralytically repellent, in ways that had nothing to do with your dorsal nerve. It saw right through you, marked what you had done, and let you know that there would be a reckoning. No signs of age touched the corners of those screwed-up, dust-storm eyes, but nonetheless, it was a gaze as elderly as Crux's. There was something in the look she gave you after she read the whole of your features, as though searching, that puzzled you. Then fell the final indignity. She hooked her finger into the seam of your hood and tugged it down to your neck so that she could look at your whole face without permission, bloodied skull and all. You flushed until the tips of your ears were red hot. Fear and humiliation formed a bone hook at the back of your superior articular facet. Acrimonious rage drove it forward, caught the loop, and withdrew it backward, as though unknitting your nerves. The scythe of pain that swept over the back of your scalp nearly made you sick again, and you would have been if you had not of late become the saint of emesis. You squeezed the nerve flat with the muscles around it, and wedged the minute hook back into your spinal mass where it belonged. This resulted in a whole body case of pins and needles so profound that all you could do was thrash like a fish on the end of a line. The finger was withdrawn. The stormy eyes widened, just fractionally. An emotion was playing out over her face that was not unfamiliar to you, but nonsensical. You discarded it.
"You oughtn't to have done that," she said. "You might have blown out your dorsal nerve and asphyxiated."
She looked at your face and saw what was so nakedly writ there, disbelief that she could perceive what you'd done.
"No, I cannot sense you," she said, in answer to your unspoken dismay. "But your body is not a mystery to me. I may know it better than you do. You ninth baby."
You were fumbling with the hood with clumsy hands, hiding your face.
"How old are you?" she asked abruptly. "How old in years?"
You held your flopping idiot's head up to look at her face again. For some reason, and you never needed a reason, you were very good at producing a reaction to no stimulus whatsoever. You became afraid. It was then that the body emerged from behind the lictor's shoulder, squatting somewhere close to the doors. Her sweet dead face floated a little behind the lictor's. She looked at you with her heavy-lidded yellow-gold eyes, and she said, quite clearly, with the voice of Iglamine and your mother commingled,
"Lie, Harrow! Now!"
15, you said immediately, hoping your own meat would not betray you. She pressed.
"Counting from conception or from birth?"
"Birth." That emotion played out over the face again, like the ripple of darkness across a briefly disturbed body of water. The whole body clenched and unclenched. It didn't matter that she was a black hole to you, without thanagy or thallergy to speak of. It was just a matter of seeing her shoulders. It was relief. It was unalloyed, full-bore relief.
"Yuck," she said.
The elevator came to a thudding halt. The doors behind the lictor opened. She stood, then looked down at you. The relief was gone. The distance remained.
"I have asked the Emperor multiple times why he has allowed himself to sit, exposed, for this long on the edge of the place he must not come back to," she said. "And the reason turns out to be you. Some lost ninth scrap who never had anything to do with anything. And nobody. But he acted so surprised. I said, put an age requirement in the letter. I said, everyone will be pubescent if you don't. And now we reap what he sowed. Hiss." For a moment, you thought you'd had an oral hallucination, that nobody who had lived 10,000 years, that nobody who had lived, would verbalize the word hiss. "Well, you have 3 options. You can walk with me now to the shuttle, I can wheel you, or I can drag you. Which do you pick, you half-grown juvenile? I will tell you, the other one walked."
You stood up. It cost you.
"Good," she said, looking at you critically. "You look like a bat stuck in a birthday cake, and you need at least 2 haircuts. But you are. You will be. You were. God's breath and God's bones."
The lictor rearranged your hood a little bit and smoothed out the shoulders of your robe. For this you vowed to one day take her dorsal nerve. Then looked at the sword webbed into your arm, bent nearly double beneath its weight and your weariness. Her expression said quite clearly what she thought of it, but she had seen your naked face, and perhaps seen something there. Perhaps your plans for her dorsal nerve.
"You're not as pretty as Anastasia," was all she said.
Now the reverend daughter followed more like a cavalier of her house than a necromancer of it. You creaked like a packed skeleton beneath the weight of a burden, following in the lictor's wake. Thankfully, you no longer felt shame. Pride was swiftly becoming a planet you had travelled to once, but no longer remembered in detail. The docking bay she led you into was a hive of activity. A speaker gave a belated parp of, "Our Lady, the Saint of Joy, is gracing Docking Bay 14. Yet this did not seem to encourage everyone to scurry into the gleaming steel and bone culverts of the ship, but rather to take whatever they were doing into double time. Whatever they were doing involved primarily a shuttle. It was not large. It was of a size, in fact, with the type that had used to bring the ninth house lightbulb filaments and vitamin supplements, manned by a single pilot who always looked as though he had gained the job by losing a bet. There were boxes being carried up into it. You were distracted by the beating hearts and muscles straining all around you, weeping lactic acid as they slid and locked containers and crates into position. At the top of the ramp, sitting on an upturned container in a whisper of opaline skirts and distinct peevishness, was Ianthe. Her focus was on the back of the shuttle, not on you. She sat within the sea of heaving stacks and bundles like a pillar.
"All right," said the Saint of Joy. "Chop, chop, get in there and don't move an inch. Don't get in anybody's way. Just go in and sit and be good."
The cohort officers saluted Ianthe as they passed her up and down the ramp. You noticed the ones who reeked of thanagy kiss their thumbs in a gesture you did not recognize. As you dragged your numb, idiot body across the bay and staggered up the ramp, you were grateful that nobody did the same for you. You were once again given the wide berth accorded to a ninth house necromancer. The inside was as cramped as you'd suspected, and sordidly simple. What arrested you immediately was the source of Ianthe's fascination and open admiration. Before the back wall of the shuttle, a necromancer of the cohort squatted. Necromantic miasma shone upon her as brightly to you as a torch. There was no fuel here for her to use to commit necromancy. She was in deep space, and she was not a lictor. What she could do was put the final touches on an exquisite nullification ward, wet and red with her own blood, which was being pumped out from a long syringe. It would have been difficult and arduous work even had she access to her aptitude. The arms of her robes were rolled all the way up to her shoulders so that the cloth would not touch and blur the pattern as she worked. You noted rucked-up house ribbons of pale seafoam green. Ianthe saw you, and she startled. Before you could be relieved that there existed one lictor who might still startle for you, she made room for you on the upturned crate on which she was perched. You did not like to, but you sat primly on the corner proffered, trying to press your knees together to stop your bodies from touching. Today, and how much time had passed, her eyes were that washed-out blue with amethyst lights in them. "You've met our respected elder sister, I see," Ianthe said. "She accused me of being 12, called me one of those animophiliacs, then told me I wasn't as good-looking as someone called Cyrus. It was like being back with Mummy," she added, with a touch of fond nostalgia. Your palm remembered the knife, and you resisted the chumminess. You said, "Where is the Emperor?" "I don't know, and nobody will tell me anything," she said more peevishly. "Everyone has been acting frankly mulish, which I suppose I can't blame them for, as I might act the same if I were peremptorily dropped from the Emperor's personal attaché and shipped off to the front. But what is the good of being Ianthe the First if I can't even leverage it?" You hazarded a quick glance to the cohort necromancer, but the seventh adept paid you no attention. You noticed that her ward, an expert's work and an artist's, that of genius married to style, was a very familiar one. It was a ghost ward. You tried to wrench your brain back to the words Ianthe had said and the order she had put them in. This was difficult, as what you knew about the cohort and the front could fit into a teaspoon. Even that much knowledge had always annoyed you, but something she'd said had rattled your comatose hypothalamus. You said, "That makes no sense. The Imperial Guard doesn't see action." "Oh, my sweet. You don't know. Well, how could you? It's not as though anyone's told you. You are too busy with your binary of throwing up or being murderous. Well, Nona Jesmus, they do see action when the cohort suddenly loses 3 warships to as many orbital radiation missiles, which is 3 more warships than we've lost in the past 1,000 years, said Ianthe. Were it possible for someone to puff more with self-satisfaction, she would be swollen and gouty and dead. But rather than irritated, you found that Ianthe just made you feel tired. 18,000 dead soldiers will grab the attention. Corona would love it. She's mad for military funerals. It was difficult for you to muster empathy. You had nobody at the front, or indeed in the cohort. The last 9th House chaplains and construct adepts had, as you recalled, been lost in action 5 years back. The numbers remained numbers, lacking context. You were more interested in the conversation happening outside the shuttle's docking doors before the ramp, an unfamiliar voice saying steadily, "Holy Saint, the Erebos is his vessel. I speak for every commanding officer aboard when I tell you how reluctantly we would see the end of his 80 years aboard."
80 years?
was the response, again with that articulated extra exclamation point. It was the result of extreme irascibility. The saint had a high, fluting voice, a young voice for someone who had now accused both you and Ianthe Tridentarius of actionable puberty, and it was piercing now.
It is shameful! You knew the writing was on the wall when the call came for more lictors. His seat is elsewhere, and there he must return, and should have returned 30 years ago. You're now Admiral Sarpedon. Really? It is Sarpedon, isn't it?
Yes, said the Admiral, whose title had been suggested by the lictor in the same tone of voice as might be said Chief Leper. And it has been 20 years since we last met, most venerated saint?
Around that,
agreed the most venerated saint, whose office had been enunciated by the Admiral with the faintest and most well-bred suggestion of motherfucker.
In any case, you have had him 80 years, and the Mithraeum has lacked him for 100.
You are invoking throne silence, said Sarpedon. You are removing him from the Empire.
I can't very well invoke throne speech. We'll be 40 billion light-years away.
The Admiral said, through a thin rime of ice,
He has expressed in no uncertain terms his close personal interest in this war.
He can very well maintain a close personal interest in it from 40 billion light-years away, said the Saint of Joy, who had just strongly implied the opposite.
Her name was sounding increasingly ironic to you.
I do not blush to remove the Emperor from his enemies. I do not blush ensuring the God of the Nine Houses is not molested by those who hate him.
I do not recognize, said Sarpedon, any such frailty in the God who became man, nor the man who became God, nor the Necro-Lord Prime who may resurrect a galaxy with a gesture.
The lictor's voice rose further.
The risen star Dominicus gives light and life to the Nine Houses, and yet I don't think we should crash anything into it. You just wore out my last nerve, Sarpedon, and I still remember when there were fewer pips on your shirt, so I would ask that you not mistake a lictor for someone you can...
There was a shout from the other side of the 14th cargo hold. It was the voice of the god who became man, and the man who became god. He approached the ramp at a swift clip, making a beeline for the boiling mad Saint of Joy. Beside you, Ianthe smacked her lips as though in anticipation of a good meal, a sort of mlim, mlim, mlim. But the Emperor wrapped his arms around his lictor as though she were a precious and runaway child. He pressed her to him, drawing down the hood and tousling that overripe rose-tinted hair, heedless of the curtsying, bowing cohort officers in the wake of his passage. She froze as though dipped in liquid nitrogen. He said something that you couldn't catch, and then,
Thank you for your work here. You have done well.
The Saint of Joy was ramrod straight and still, as though her feet had been fixed to the docking bay floor with big steel pins. The Emperor of the Nine Houses turned from her to the Admiral, who was half into his own genuflection, pressing a hand to his shoulder and immediately embarking on a low conversation you could only catch in bits.
No hurry going around the belt. If the wind off Dominicus gives you problems, take the same route back. Subluminary speed's fine. After you do your deliveries, stelitic travel will get you out of the supercluster and back to the second arm of the fleet. But you're going to have to go a lot slower than you have the past 2 weeks.
Then you do intend to leave us, Lord, said Sarpedon. He had moved so that now you could see him properly. Your new hood, unlike good Ninth House furs, was transparent enough to let you see quite clearly, albeit through a stippled violence of rainbow light. You beheld a man of middling age in a sober cohort uniform, perennial white jacket and scarlet neckerchief. The two pips on his collar were ringed around with mother-of-pearl. If you had not heard his rank,
You would not have known what they signified. Necromantic vapour rose off him in roiling waves like sweat, unused and impotent in the vacuum of deep space. I confess that I had not prepared for it. I hate to, Admiral, said God. The Erebos has been my home. The Admiral said, a little stiffly, we are unworthy of such love.
I am unworthy of this pitiful goodbye, said the King Undying. What I planned on telling you, I will tell you now, swifter and more gracelessly. Don't get caught up in the drama of the Cohort Command. I know exactly who is behind this terrible blow, and they were fools to show their hand. They have revealed themselves to be as coarse and juvenile and foolish as the act they have just committed, but our retaliation should not be swift. Let them understand the inevitability of the Nine Houses.
As inexorable as death, said the Admiral.
And as kind, said the Emperor. You have shown your loyalty to me, Sarpedon, and I have never questioned you. You made the Erebos my respite, but, as I imagine, you have just been told.
Did the Saint of Joy writhe at that? Or were you imagining it?
My station is my seat, and the Erebos is needed elsewhere.
But to go unaccompanied, Lord, with the Steely, a transport ship could be out as far as the Haddles in 2 years.
18,000 good soldiers, the Emperor said gently. Take the Erebos to them, and give her a new name. Seat of the Emperor.
My Lord. The Saint of Joy muttered something beneath her breath. The Emperor did not bat an eyelid.
Yes, I know it's lowly to captain a chair, he said, but I won't have anyone in the Admiralty forget what she was, and what I hope she will be once more. In any case, the name ought to get you to the head of orbital queues, even if I'm not in residence. I'll miss her like fury, Sarpedon. But she's got thicker plates than anything else in the fleet, and when she's refitted, she'll carry 2,000.
Yet, Lord,
as for you, your bones will be hallowed in the Mithraeum for all that you've done in my service. If I don't see you before then, all I can do is hope you get a chance for retirement.
The Emperor of the Nine Houses reached out to clasp Sarpedon's hand. The Cohort Admiral looked as though he were being branded. The Emperor held this grasp, and the Admiral's gaze for a long time. Then he turned back to the ramp up the dock, followed, a little reluctantly, by his hand. As he drew closer, you could see that he looked as though he had prepared in a hurry. He carried a small bag, hastily packed, slung over his shoulder. The ever-present tablet peeked out of his pocket, along with what seemed to be at least 5 styluses, and he was dressed simply, as per usual, in a black shirt and trousers. The lack of tint had always pleased you. It was very 9th. Even the collar and the cuffs of his shirt that were scruffy and pilled from too much wearing. But he wore a crown of office that you had not seen before, a wreath of ribbon and pearlescent leaves in his dark hair, rustling prismatically in the windless docking bay. Each leaf was intertwined with a match-sized infant finger bone. He turned and strode up the ramp towards you, and he said very normally, like you'd never fainted before him in a lather of pre-puke,
"Are you all right, Harrowhark?"
"I am perfectly capable, teacher," you said.
"That's not the same thing,"
Ianthe said, with a close approximation of winsomeness.
"Put her under my care, teacher."
And you were disgusted to hear God reply,
"I will. Keep an eye on her. Now."
He turned to find the beautiful ward completed on the wall, and the 7th adept quietly dying on the floor. There was a whirl of blood down her front. At some point, she had levered her syringe deep into her subclavian artery. After finishing the final touches on the perfect nightmare spiral, which betrayed no trembling from myocardial trauma, she had sprayed fixative across it, then silently collapsed. She lay with her eyes rigid on the ceiling, hands clasped over the growing stain on the front of her robes, which were turning second house scarlet with blood. The Emperor mumbled something that, you would swear on the rock before the tomb, sounded like, for fuck's sake. After a moment's consideration, he pressed his hand to his mouth, as though in thought. The bloom that followed blinded you beyond unpicking, or even comprehending. The stain crumbled to dust. The blood ceased flowing. The seventh adept's hands clutched clean robes. Her expression changed from glassy-eyed expectation to resignation. She rolled over to kiss the dusty floor of the shuttle. You and Ianthe were left blinking, eyes and noses streaming, as though you had just eaten something slightly too spicy. "Most holy lord," she said, but there was half a question in it.
"Not today, First Lieutenant," said God. "We need necromancers like you now more than ever."
She kissed her fingers at him a little mechanically, and then to the Saint of Joy, and then to Ianthe, and then, after a pause, to you, half a dozen times, and then curtsied to the point where she nearly folded herself right in half. She rose and escaped down the ramp, booted footsteps bouncing in her wake, the only sign she had been there, the enormous wall of the ward. The Saint of Joy watched her go with an unreadable expression on her placid portrait of a face. With two more aboard, you could see how small the shuttle really was. To your left, there was a partitioned area that might have been for bodily functions, or going to the toilet, as everyone else in the known universe would have put it, but otherwise the space was bare. There were no beds. There were no real seats for passengers, except for a few pull-downs at the side. The boxes brought on were quite small. The biggest was a stone square strapped down with lengths of steel rope. Displaced from its fellows, the tiny rosebud gone, it took you a moment to realise that it was a coffin, and another moment to recognise whose. To your right was a cockpit, with empty seating for one pilot, sprayed with a wide and beautiful wrap of embroidered pearly material, and with a lurch in the back of your brain, you saw it wasn't empty at all. The body had taken up residence on that rainbow shawl, sitting there with her hand prim in her lap and the chain of welts clearly visible. The gorgeous and severe angles of her face were softened as though in recognition, and her lips were a little parted, enough to show her dead black tongue. When you followed her line of sight, she was looking at the entryway and the Emperor. The Emperor pressed a button next to the door, and the ramp sucked up into the shuttle with a great mechanical slarp. Then he turned to his lictor and said, in a tone of thinly sprinkled sugar upon infinite salt,
"Well, this looks a great deal like forcing my hand."
"Lord, I would never dare."
"My flagship to my admiral among my people. Is the Erebos really the best place to publicly gainsay your emperor, Mercy?"
She rounded on him. The canvas of her portrait face was now scrunched up in passionate fury. You had expected that 10,000 years would be enough to school a face whenever one wanted it schooled. Apparently not, or Mercy had never bothered with schooling.
"The only one who forced your hand is coming home with us in a box," she cried out, "and it's ugly of you to use my name in front of the infants. We agreed our names were sacred. We let them all be forgotten."
"Mercy Morn," said the Emperor, "you know as well as I do that keeping your name from your rightful sisters is ridiculous. Also, you are trying to start a fight with me to get out of the fight I am trying to have with you, which is a painfully domestic tactic."
"You are nearly in Dominicus's halo. It looks suicidal."
"You know why I came, and my reasons for waiting are out of..."
"Some would call it madness, or ego, or both."
"Who's some in this instance, and does their name rhyme with Nursinorn?"
It rhymes with Augustine, said the Saint of Joy, with no small amount of hauteur. The Emperor of the Nine Houses' face suddenly lit up like the sunrise of an inner circle planet.
Then you and Augustine the First are talking again.
Massey threw her hands in the air, milking an invisible and gigantic cow in order to assuage her feelings, and flung herself to sit down on another secured crate. She put her chin in her hands. Her rapier clattered beneath her rainbow-white cloak with the movement.
We were talking, she said, chilly and measured, as little as 19 years ago, if you'd recall. If we talk again now, it doesn't actually signify being as speaking is so different from talking, and I am not on speaking terms with the person you refer to. Nonetheless, your actions moved me to talk to that silly man-shaped worm, and I came here to take matters into my own hands.
Before he could say another word, she said,
"Nobody's answering calls on the Mithraeum. Come home, please."
But that's...
Three of us remain, said the lictor simply. I can't even confirm the third is alive.
He was keeping tabs on, began the Emperor,
and seemed as though he were about to elucidate those tabs, but he caught sight of you and Ianthe sitting quietly, waiting for this dreadful conversation to end, you, or nakedly desperate for more, Ianthe. He set his little shoulder bag down in what appeared to you, wild with panic, to be the body's lap. She looked up at him, impassive, and then at the bag, nonplussed. Then he dropped down on his haunches in front of his sullen lictor. What followed was a conversation entirely in shorthand. At one point it was simply conducted in shrugs. He would say a word, she would retort with a totally different word, and the Emperor would grimace or give her sharp rejoinder. On occasion, that sharp rejoinder was simply a quirk of his mouth, and the lictor would turn her head, loser of that bout. You were watching two people who had outgrown conversation half a myriad back. It was more a dialogue between arm and elbow, heart and brain, shared via electrical impulse. At no prearranged point, they suddenly returned to normal speech, and God said,
I was going to wait on the Erebos until we had heard definitively whether or not the launch...
I don't care if it was them or not,
sniffed the Saint of Joy, Mercy Morn, whom you now knew possessed two utterly inapt names.
They're remnants. They can't do anything. Their leader has been gone for nearly 20 years. You've got to prioritize.
But this is so obviously...
I beg you to recall the stakes, Lord, said the lictor.
The Mithraeum is a destination we can reach by only one means, said God, with the air of a man pulling a final brick out of a wobbling tower. I cannot yet, in good conscience, take either of them on that journey.
You were terribly afraid that either of them had been a hasty replacement for Harrowhark. The elder lictor did not assuage your fears when she looked up at him with those unfathomable tempest eyes and said,
If you are that unsure of either of them, then put them down now. They won't thank you for keeping them alive. It's the only test that matters. Thanks.
The Emperor of the Nine Houses stood up. His lictor stood also. Her hand had twitched aside the nacreous folds of her robe to rest on the end of a simple and unpretentious rapier, the mesh nest that formed around the handle, unadorned and uncomplicated, no decoration other than a white knob at the very end of the... You didn't know the exact technical word. It was a pommel, though. He said,
Prepare to launch. I'll make the call.
And you knew that somehow Mercy had won the war. It was with a strange admixture of relief and hard, resentful shame that Mercy stood and leaned over the pilot's chair, flicking switches, avoiding the body by a hair's breadth. The switches made nice haptic clanks within their plex housings, and more lights came on overhead,
bathing you all in an unpleasantly orange glow. Though there was no change in God's pitch or cadence, his voice had taken on a different cast. It was as though a steel tool had been taken from its housing. He said,
"Double-check those boxes. Get them in the straps. Make sure that one's nice and tight. Ianthe, there are belt chairs by that window. Harrow, I want that sword out of your hands and fixed to the floor. Use marrow in the bone. I don't want it to crack or bend."
You and Ianthe knelt to fix the containers at his instruction. You reluctantly melted the comb of bone attaching your sword to your straining arm. As an afterthought, you did what you had been told to in the letter from your past self. You iced the whole blade over with a casing of bone and found the result significantly more pleasing to the eye and brain. You could never castrate its anger, but thus sheathed the sword, that object of your resentment and hate and protective panic, could be dimmed somewhat, like a lampshade dimmed a lamp. Afterward, you dropped into a pull-down seat next to Ianthe and clicked the safety belt together while your bare feet kept troth with the bone-enameled sword, and you watched God's final test of metal hasps and cinches on the boxes. He brushed his hand very lightly over the secured stone of the coffin, the very briefest of touches, before stopping in front of the ward that had been applied to the wall. He pressed the tip of his little finger to one of the walls, very gently, as though afraid to hurt it. The fetal finger bones and leaves crowning his hair kept swaying in some non-existent breeze.
"Brilliantly executed. Nearly perfect levels of carbon dioxide in the fixative," he said, taking a stylus from his pocket. "She was much too good to die for it, Mercy."
"I didn't tell her to die for it," said Mercy Morton snappishly.
With a sudden clunk, the open door to the shuttle started descending, groaning into place where the ramp had disappeared. It fell into its housing with a ker-chunk.
"Her going full atria was perfectly over the top. The crew on your horrible flagships are always trying to martyr themselves whenever you so much as ask for an orange juice."
"I'm telling Sarpedon to give her a commendation," he said, tapping at his tablet. "That will have to do. It's not exactly an appropriate thank you for nearly bleeding out."
The communicator at the pilot's chair crackled. The Admiral's voice in question said clearly,
"My Lord, you're cleared to leave. We await your word." "Loose the clamps," said the Emperor. "The clamps are set for release," said Admiral Sarpedon.
Then he cleared his throat and began what you now thought of as the common prayer.
"Let the King Undying, Ransomer of Death, Scourge of Death, Vindicator of Death, look upon the Nine Houses and hear their thanks."
And from behind him joined in the tinny voices of the entire docking crew.
"Let the whole of everywhere entrust themselves to him."
You peered over your shoulder at the porthole. The dimmed interior of Docking Bay 14 was lightening. They were opening up some outer airlock, and the shuttle itself was travelling on rails as though to be offered to space like a sacrifice. The velvety blackness of the outside world became naked. Cold stars burnt in the distance. The body came to stand next to you all of a sudden, and you had to school yourself not to reach for the hem of her dirty white shift, the pallid, dimpled flesh of her calf. You were leaving. For where, you did not know. And you did not know how to feel. Ianthe kept her eyes downcast, modest and pliant, as though this sickening and poorly acted role would convince anyone with a brain. She sat with her rapier belted at her hip beneath her robe, raising bumps beneath the mother-of-pearl cloth. And when you caught her gaze beneath those pallid lashes, you could see the hot anticipation in her eyes, one blue, one purple, of someone about to be announced for an award. She was deeply excited. that starry, far-off gaze refocused on you, and she whispered coyly, "Should we hold hands in girlish solidarity?" At your expression, she puffed away a strand of colourless hair and remarked, "You're the one who investigated my tonsils." Over the prayer, still crackling through the speaker grill, Mercy said, "Releasing in 30. And the Emperor, "Don't triangulate. We don't want to put them in danger. We'll hold course until the Erebos is out of our radius." He took the lovely rainbow shawl and draped it over the pilot's chair, and Mercy Morn daintily sat down upon it, belting herself in. The body was gone. Little clusters of bone set over the cockpit window tinkled musically with the displaced air. The Emperor stood behind Mercy, one hand on the chair back, himself a light plex jangle of styluses whenever he moved, and he leant down to press down on the comm button. The prayer stopped, as though everyone praying had lost the air from their lungs. "Our enemies have once more raised their hands to those who would be at peace with them," he said. "Again we are a violated covenant, and again we are struck at with anger and with fear by those who cannot reason and those who cannot forgive what we are. You who have served on the Erebos, my soldiers and necromancers of the Nine Houses,